you've taken the whole week off is always an interesting endeavor. And so I'm taking this opportunity this morning to share some thoughts that a friend of mine shared with me several years ago around this passage and around doubts and belief. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless God's holy name. There is the story of a distressed woman who wrote Martin Luther for some reassurance. She was desperate to have the assurance of her salvation, and no matter how much she tried to accept the concept of salvation by grace through faith, she had doubts. Now, it's not known exactly what Luther said, but his response went something like this: just throw yourself on the mercy of God and stop your blathering. Luther wasn't always the most pastoral person. Now, when we say he wasn't pastoral, what we really mean is he wasn't always nice. The Methodist revival had its birth in the Wesley brothers' search for assurance, for their desire to know without a doubt that they were saved from the wrath to come. While the Wesley boys had many profound spiritual experiences and nurtured a seemingly ever-strengthening relationship with Christ, I don't think they ever found that spiritual state that they were looking for, that state of absolutely no doubt. In fact, I'm not sure that that state exists. Paul Tillich maintained that doubt is a part of faith. The two go hand in hand. If you are without doubt, it's because you are without faith. A lot of people think the opposite of faith is doubt, but it's not. The opposite of faith is indifference. Frederick Buechner was not as profound a theologian as Paul Tillich, but he stated things more clearly. He was a better writer. And in his book, Wishful Thinking, he writes, "Doubts are the ants in the pants of faith. They keep it awake and moving." And my friend added that they keep us squirming and maybe just a little bit uncomfortable as well. So if doubt is a part of faith, why do we keep giving Thomas such a hard time? Doubting Thomas, we've named him. And we don't necessarily mean that as a compliment. We mean it as a contrast to the believing disciples. There were those who believed Jesus had been raised, and then there was Thomas who doubted. We are forgetting, of course, that all of those other disciples had had that experience that Thomas said he needed. They had seen the risen Lord. They had seen the wound. John tells us the story here as the disciples had gathered, perhaps in the very upper room where they had celebrated the Passover meal with Jesus just a few days before. It's evening, and you can assume that they've gathered for a meal. Being religious Jews, there would have been prayers and blessings, perhaps even some remembrances of other meals with Jesus. And suddenly, Jesus is present with them, in spite of the fact that the doors are barred and locked. And he greets them with what would be considered a pretty absurd greeting. Shalom, peace be with you. I don't know about you, but if Jesus showed up in a locked room where I was, the last thing I would be feeling would be peace. And I don't think the disciples were necessarily full of peace in those moments either, with Jesus suddenly there before them. The doors were locked because they were afraid for their lives, and there's some dispute. Were they afraid of what the Jews might do to them? Because they had been followers of Jesus who was now crucified. Were they afraid the Romans might come wondering if they had stolen the body and locked them up? But there's others believe that they were afraid of Jesus. Hearing that the tomb was empty, what was Jesus going to do to this group who didn't believe? This group who had abandoned him, this group who had betrayed him, this group who had denied even knowing him. And so Jesus shows up in the midst of that fear and says, "Peace." See, he seems to be saying, see, the world has done its worst, but I have overcome the world. And because it doesn't seem like the disciples really were instantly filled with peace, he says it again, "Shalom, peace be with you." And then as they start to grasp the reality of what's happening, as they start maybe to internalize that peace that Jesus was offering to them, he breathes the Holy Spirit into them and sends them out, he says, just as God had sent him. Thomas is the first one to whom they are sent, the first one to whom they witness, and he doesn't believe them. Kind of mirrors some of our attempts at sharing Jesus with other folks, doesn't it? Now, you have to give Thomas credit. Theirs was a pretty incredulous claim. Thomas wasn't yet ready to believe the unbelievable. He wanted proof. He wanted to experience what they had experienced. That next Sunday, a week later, on the eighth day, we are told, Thomas is with them at that table again. The risen Lord is also present in the assembly. And I think that that's an important part of John's story. That Christ comes into the assembly as they gather at the table. And now he shows Thomas his wounds. And Thomas is changed. Not by proof. There's no evidence that Thomas actually took Jesus up on his offer to touch the wounds in his hands or his side. But he is changed by belief. And he falls on his knees and confesses that Jesus is Lord and God. And that was a risky thing to do in those days, for claiming anybody to be Lord, for bowing down and worshiping anybody but emperor, but the emperor was akin to treason, and you were putting one's life on the line. But Thomas had been converted, if you will. He had come to believe, and he no longer feared what a mere emperor could do to him. In his book, Speaking Christian, Marcus Borg makes some interesting observations about the words we Christians use all the time and what they mean now is what they might have meant as opposed to those early Christians' meaning. Belief is one of those words. We think of belief as accepting as true that we can't prove. I believe it, but I take your word for it. I mean, I don't really know for sure, but I'm going to believe that what you tell me is true. The Latin root credo, I believe, Borg writes, is connected with the heart, however, not with the mind. It's not trusting in what someone else says. Belief is connected with the center of our life, and it meant something more to those early Christians like, I give my heart to. To believe for ancient people meant to give your loyalty to someone, not to agree with a statement, to agree with something that may or may not be factual. It's not saying, I believe in what you're saying. To believe is to say, I believe in you. In English, prior to 1600, Borg writes that the word believe didn't mean, I believe that. In this case, it didn't mean, I believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. It means, I believe in you. I have confidence in you. I trust in you. We still have an inkling of that meaning. We might say it to our kids when they're struggling to accomplish something, right? I believe in you. I trust that you can do this. The old English word for belief actually meant to hold dear, like calling someone a beloved. When Thomas says, "My Lord and my God," he's not saying, "Oh, I believe Jesus is now raised from the dead." What he's really saying is he believes in the person of Jesus. He's committing himself not to an idea or to a doctrine, but he's committing himself to a person, to a relationship. Thomas made that great confession, "My Lord and my God," not as an intellectual assent to a doctrine, but as an affirmation of the relationship he had with the risen Lord. And I'm glad that he did what he did. You see, his doubt is not an indication of a lack of faith, a lack of commitment or loyalty, but it's an indication that he was not indifferent. It was a matter of great importance to him whether it was really Jesus who stood before him. The indifferent don't struggle with doubts because they just don't really care whether what is before them is true or not. But Thomas cared. Thomas knew that it mattered. Doubts can actually be a sign of the importance of what you're wrestling with, not a sign of a lack of faith. I'm leery of those who are absolutely certain beyond any shadow of a doubt of anything. A little healthy doubt can be a good thing. Remember saying to more than one person and having it been said to me, that it makes me believe that if you think if you say something loud enough, that it's going to make it true. I think sometimes it's easier to be more inclined to listen to those who speak in a quiet voice. A quiet voice of faith, maybe mixed with just a little bit of doubt. I don't believe that Jesus appeared to his disciples so that they would believe that he was raised from the dead. I mean, that obviously would be part of what happened. But I believe Jesus appeared to his disciples that they would believe in him. Not to remove their doubts about whether he was really alive, but to remove their doubts about whether they could trust in him. To remove their doubts about whether this relationship that they had started with him was worth it. To remove their doubts about whether Jesus was one in whom they could place their trust. If belief is about relationship, then we are all dancing this dance between faith and doubt. Our life experience might tell us that Jesus is not raised from the dead. For if he is, then why am I suffering? Why have my kids drifted away from the church? Why does everything I seem to do not work out the way I wanted it to? Why is there so much suffering in the world? Why is there so much hatred and division? Why is there so much murder and killing? But then faith grabs us by the hand. It twirls us around, and we come face to face in the midst of those doubts with the risen Lord, much like Thomas found himself face to face with Jesus. And even though the doors seem shut, and even though we might be cowering in fear, we come to believe once again. Not because of some words we say in a creed, not even because some words printed on the page in scriptures, not even because of the testimony of others, but we come to believe once again because we experience Jesus. And that experience of Jesus is stronger than the experience we encounter in this world. Our experience of one in whom we can trust is stronger than the experience we have with our doubts and with our questions and with our uncertainty. And so when we doubt, it's okay. In fact, my experience has been that it is in the midst of doubts that Jesus is more likely to show up than he is in the midst of certainty. He's more likely to show up in times of fear than in times of strength and confidence. He is more likely to show up when we really, truly need to know that he is risen, that he is in relationship with us, and that he is the one in whom we can place our trust. And so next time you doubt, be thankful. because those doubts are an opportunity for Christ to appear, to reach out his hands and to say, "Peace be with you." Let it be so. Amen.